From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow is World AIDS Day. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of the most experienced AIDS doctors in the country, Dr. Marcus Conant. He began treating patients before it was understood what AIDS was or how it was transmitted. Conant now has the largest private practice dealing with AIDS patients in San Francisco. Also today, Tony Trischka. He's been called the premier banjo madman of our time. His new album is a history of banjo styles, from African song to rock. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Pictures at an Execution by Wendy Lesser about why we are so fascinated with murder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton signed the Brady Bill into law today, establishing a 5-day waiting period for the purchase of handguns and a background check for potential buyers. The president told guests at the signing ceremony that the passage of the Brady Bill shows that the country is finally fed up with violence. In his words, "We know that this bill will make a difference." The law is named for Jim Brady, the former White House press secretary who was severely disabled in a 1981 attempt to kill President Reagan. Ethiopian representatives are working to restart Somali peace talks, which broke off over the summer because of renewed violence. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Addis Ababa.
As a UN conference on aid to Somalia continued today, Ethiopian officials were engaged in heavy shuttle diplomacy between two hotels in town. One hotel houses officials from the Somali political factions that support the UN and are attending the aid conference. The other hotel houses the factions aligned with General Idid, factions that came to Ethiopia but which refused to attend the UN meeting. It seems the Ethiopian government has convinced the opposing groups to meet on Thursday and Friday, the first peace talks in months. Idid's faction has boycotted all UN-sponsored negotiations since June, when the UN accused Idid of killing international peacekeepers. A senior U.S. official says the UN will have nothing to do with these new peace talks to assure that Idid's faction shows up. This is Michael Scholar in Addis Ababa.
The government-run North Korean news agency said today Pyongyang would never yield to U.S. pressure to open its nuclear sites to inspection and is prepared for sanctions or even war. U.S. officials say these threats are nothing new. They're waiting for more definitive answers to their recent proposals. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Following meetings last week, President Clinton and South Korean President Kim Jong-sam said North Korea could expect a broad and thorough review of issues once it lives up to its obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. North Korea has limited inspections of some nuclear sites while barring others altogether, fueling fears North Korea has a nuclear weapons program. After the White House meeting, American officials passed on the proposals to the North Koreans with the warning if North Korea fails to live up to its commitments, international pressure would be brought to bear. Using their press, North Korean officials replied, "America shouldn't threaten sanctions if it wants North Korea to obey." Though on the surface this doesn't look promising, U.S. officials today dismissed these remarks as propaganda. Refusing to overreact, as one put it, officials are still awaiting a formal answer. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The Dow Industrials gained 6 points today to close at 3,684. This is NPR. The trial of 9 men accused of conspiring to overthrow former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev is underway today in Moscow, with testimony from the former head of the Soviet intelligence agency. Former KGB chief Vladimir Kryushkov told the Russian court that the failed 1991 coup was an attempt to stop the destruction of the Soviet Union. He denied committing treason and said he can't be tried for it anyway, since the Soviet Union no longer exists. The alleged coup plotters face the death penalty if they're convicted. President Clinton's choice to head the government's Savings and Loan Cleanup Office withdrew his nomination today. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Florida real estate developer Stanley Tate sent a letter to the president asking that his nomination to head the Resolution Trust Corporation, or RTC, be withdrawn. Tate cited anonymous death threats and the opposition of Senate Banking Committee Chairman Donald Riegel as the reasons for his action. Tate said Riegel had refused to hold a hearing on his nomination for reasons Tate told the president he did not understand. Tate also referred to anonymous telephone threats, which he attributed to RTC employees, whom he said were afraid of his promises to clean up waste and possible fraud in the office charged with overseeing the massive SNL bailout. But Tate's nomination first ran into trouble when press reports accused him of improperly using his own influence as an RTC official to help associates. In his letter to the president, Tate denied those charges. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Michigan Dr. Jack Kevorkian was ordered to jail today after his arraignment on a third charge of assisting a suicide. A judge set bail for the retired pathologist at $50,000. Kevorkian was then taken to Detroit for a federal court hearing on his complaint that police harassed him and searched his apartment without a warrant on Sunday. Kevorkian was declared a fugitive last night after he failed to show up for an arraignment. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow is International AIDS Day. My guest, Dr. Marcus Conant, was one of the first doctors to treat people with AIDS. Now he runs the largest private practice specializing in AIDS in San Francisco. Dr. Conant is one of the people featured in the four-part documentary A Time of AIDS, which continues on the Discovery Channel December 5th and 12th. There was an interesting and disturbing article about AIDS in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It was written by Jeffrey Schmaltz, a New York Times reporter who made AIDS his beat after he contracted the disease. He died 3 weeks before this magazine article's publication. Schmaltz wrote, "Once AIDS was the hot topic in America, what small advances had been won are now crumbling. The world is moving on, uncaring, frustrated, and bored, leaving by the roadside those of us who are infected and who can't help but wonder whatever happened to AIDS." I wanted to know if Dr. Conant shares Schmaltz's fear that many Americans have lost interest in AIDS.
I do, and I share it for a number of reasons. I think if you look at the United States today, we are complacent that we are doing something about the AIDS epidemic, when in truth, we are losing 50,000 people a year to AIDS, and 50,000 new infections are occurring each year. We've got a steady state epidemic, and when you look around the world, at Southeast Asia and at Sub-Sahara Africa, as you and everyone who reads the paper knows, the epidemic is soaring. So while we don't talk about AIDS anymore in the United States, the AIDS epidemic has certainly not gone away.
Schmaltz made the observation that even the gay movement has pushed AIDS to the sideline. Do you think that's true?
To a degree, yes. I think that, as Jeffrey said in his article, that too many people are tired of hearing of death. They want to hear something positive. The numbing experience of the mid-80s have created a whole new generation of gay men who are anxious to move on beyond AIDS, who are looking for something else in the gay movement besides AIDS. And I think that's why there was so much attention earlier this year to gays in the military. Not that many gay men want to actually serve in the military, but it was a new focus. It was something else the gay community could focus on other than what had occupied them for 12 years.
What impact do you think Clinton has had since he entered the White House?
Well, Clinton is certainly better than Reagan and Bush in terms of being sympathetic to this problem. I share with Jeffrey Schmaltz the concern that the Clinton administration doesn't know what to do about the problem. And I think that too much they are listening to bureaucrats who are conveying to them the sense of frustration that the bureaucracy feels being unable to respond to this epidemic. I mean, let's break that apart. To stop the AIDS epidemic, you need education, you need prevention programs, you need treatment for the people who are sick and dying, and you need an active vaccine program. And of course, the bureaucrats in Washington that are primarily advising Clinton are telling him how frustrated they feel in attacking each of those areas. Education is impossible in this country because we can't discuss sexuality with our children. Prevention is impossible in this country because simple programs like needle exchange are not possible in this country. Treatment was dealt a terrible blow by the Concord data, which was presented in Berlin, showing that not only did AZT and the other antiretrovirals not work as well as we had hoped, they don't appear to work for more than about 2 or 3 years. And so while we thought we were making progress 2 years ago, those hopes were dashed in Berlin. And finally, if you look at the vaccine development programs, they are minuscule. There are less than a half a dozen companies in this country working on vaccines. So I can understand why the bureaucrats, who in fact are slowing down this process, are feeling frustrated. And of course, they're conveying this to the administration. And the message we're getting back from Washington is we're moving as fast as we can. That's not true. We could move much faster if we had people with vision and we had true leaders in there setting the appropriate agendas.
What do you think could be done with the right leadership?
Oh, there's a tremendous amount that could be done, Terry. Let's just take two of the issues that I talked about. Let's take needle exchange programs. It is clear after a decade of studying this disease that the next major group of people in the United States that are going to be infected with AIDS are intravenous drug users and their sexual partners who don't use drugs. In New York City, there are about 250,000 intravenous drug users, and 60% or more of those have already been infected. You're talking about 180 to 200,000 intravenous drug users who are going to get sick and die of this disease over the next decade. Those people are having sex, and the women and the men they're having sex with are going to contract this disease and, in fact, pass the disease on to their unborn children. In San Francisco, where I am, we have about 12,000 intravenous drug users, and only between 12 and 15%, not 60 to 70%, of our intravenous drug users have been infected. We could substantially stop the further transmission of this disease by distributing clean needles. And yet recently, the governor of the state of California said that even though he knew people would die of AIDS if clean needles were not distributed, he felt that by distributing needles, it would send a message that this government condones intravenous drug use. Now, no one condones intravenous drug use. We need a program to stop intravenous drug use. But is it a capital crime? Should we say that people who use drugs deserve to die? And that's what's happening in this country. So we could tomorrow have a national, well-controlled needle exchange program where we could start working with addicts to make them understand that while we don't approve of what they're doing, they could use clean needles and not transmit the disease. If you look at vaccine development, this country should, initiate an international vaccine development program utilizing traditional vaccine methods, which means whole killed virus and inactivated virus, for vaccines, as well as some of the elegant subunit vaccines that are being looked at by companies such as Chiron and Genentech. In other words, we need a multidisciplinary program looking at all of the different vaccine strategies, testing them in areas where the disease is spreading rapidly. If you look at street prostitutes in India, only 5 or 6% are currently infected. Over the next decade, that will rise to 60%. And we have good evidence for that from Thailand. Those individuals would be ideal candidates for new vaccine trials to find ways of reducing the transmission of this disease. This country should take a leadership position in those types of initiatives.
Do you think that in your position as heading up a large private practice dealing with AIDS, that you are seeing things that others might not be in a position to see in terms of the progress, you know, the progression of the illness?
We're seeing some hopeful signs, Terry, in terms of progression of illness. When I started doing this 12 years ago, the average time between a diagnosis of AIDS, using the old definition, and death was about 6 months. And now in our clinic, that's more than 40 months. It's patients are living seven times longer than they did a decade ago.
Why are they living longer?
I think there are five reasons. And briefly stated, the first is natural selection. Some people get sick and die of this disease sooner than others, and we can do very little about that. That has to do with your genetics. And so we have selected for people who are survivors, who are living longer. But even more important, I think that the prophylactic treatment against the diseases that used to kill patients, prophylaxing against pneumocystis, prophylaxing against cryptococcal meningitis, prophylaxing and preventing with drugs, Mycobacterium avium complex, those kinds of approaches are substantially prolonging the lives of our patients. Then I think aggressive patient involvement, patients going and finding doctors who are aggressive, who will treat their disease aggressively, patients who are not content with the doctor saying, well, there's not much we can do, why don't you come back in 3 months? Those patients are living longer. I think physicians are becoming more aggressive. 10 years ago, I was told repeatedly, oh, there's no need to treat this patient with nutrients given by vein because, quote, he's going to die anyway. Nowadays, we know that if you're aggressive, if you manage patients aggressively, if you manage the infections they present with, these patients live longer. And the fifth element is antiretroviral therapy, AZT, DDC, DDI, alone or in combination. And you take all five of these things and put them together, and we see patients living longer. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that we're more than a decade into an epidemic of an infectious disease caused by a virus, and we still don't understand how the virus makes us sick, and we don't have in the pipeline effective drugs that we think are going to substantially block the progression of that virus in the short run.
Are the demographics of the patients that you're seeing changing as the demographics of the epidemic changes?
The
statistics are that, you know, the largest new percentage of people getting infected are women and minorities, intravenous drug users.
Right, and you're absolutely right. The figures show that now between 12% and 15% of all of the new cases are amongst women, and that's absolutely terrifying. Because as these women become infected, they will, as a matter of course, infect their unborn children. We're not seeing that in our practice here in San Francisco because of a variety of factors, including entitlement. Ours is a private practice where we see patients who have insurance that pays for their medical care. The places where we are seeing increases in infected women and children, of course, are substantially in the inner cities, places like Baltimore and Brooklyn and the Bronx. And in those clinics, they are seeing substantial rises in the numbers of women and children infected with HIV. As everyone predicted back in the early 1980s, I think that your audience must remember that there were many of us, Matilda Krim and me and many, many others, telling Congress back in 1983 exactly what we were going to see. And we had people like Jesse Helms on the floor of the United States Senate saying that's not true. If homosexuals will just quit having sex, this disease will stop. Now, that was not true. It has not been true. And we have been badly served by that type of advice because that type of advice has kept us from bringing to the American people the kinds of information that was necessary to stop a fatal epidemic.
My guest is Dr. Marcus Conant, one of the most experienced AIDS doctors in the country. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marcus Conant, and he's been treating people with AIDS since the very start of the epidemic. He's considered to have what is perhaps the largest private practice dealing with AIDS. What is it like for you in trying to keep up the hopes of your patients when on a kind of political level, on a scientific research level, you're in fact very pessimistic about hope for the near future?
Well, I sound pessimistic, but we continue to look for new initiatives to move some of these agendas along. I think that if we just give up, if we do what has happened to many, where we just throw up our hands and say, what can we do, then the future is indeed bleak. If we realize that it is our responsibility to take this epidemic into our own hands and to find solutions for these problems, then I think that we can be hopeful. If we continue to believe that we're going to see answers from the U.S. government, I think that we are going to face failure. And what we need to do, Terry, is to look at, okay, that's not working. What can we do that will work? And let me give you a brief example. For women's reproductive health, many of the pharmaceutical companies of America got out of that business in the early 1970s because of lawsuits and pressure from the religious right against drugs such as birth control pills. a private, not-for-profit foundation called the Population Council was set up, and most of the research on women's reproductive health in the United States over the last decade, two decades, have been done by that organization. And indeed, Norplant was brought to market by research that was coordinated and funded through the Population Council. So what you have is a private, not-for-profit foundation doing what the pharmaceutical industry and the federal government could not or would not fund and implement. Perhaps with AIDS we need something like that. Perhaps we need to say the government's failing us, the pharmaceutical industries are too focused on patents that run for 17 years and the bottom line. The vaccine companies won't develop vaccines because they don't see a market in the United States. Perhaps we need to look at private, not-for-profit foundations, get funding from major funders around the world, such as the World Bank, and look at developing what the world needs, which is an effective vaccine and hopefully more beneficial treatments.
Dr. Conant, what has it been like for you to treat people with AIDS for so long? You must have seen so many of your patients die. It's, I think, very difficult for a doctor to keep with an epidemic like this.
Terry, a number of things keep you going, and while there have been days where I've said, yes, I'm going to quit this and move to New York, and while there have been days when you don't want to do it anymore, and I would be foolish to suggest those don't occur and continue to occur, overall, given 12 years of working with something which is scientifically as exciting as the AIDS epidemic, this has been a true privilege. Very few physicians are ever afforded the opportunity of being at the center of a major medical catastrophe at a point in their career where they had the resources to really deal with that medical emergency. I think one of the reasons that you can avoid burnout, which is suggested by your question, is, you know, how do you do this day after day and watch your friends die, is that you stay focused in your day-to-day practice on what you can do. If you believe for a moment that you can prolong someone's life unreasonably, if you believe that you can conquer the disease, if you believe that you will not ultimately lose, then of course when the patient dies, you're devastated. If you focus on what you can do, which is I can keep this man working till the end, I can keep him comfortable, I can keep him happy, and when he dies, whereas everyone else in society has fled and abandoned him, we have not. We have been there for him through this disease up to the end, then you can feel very positive about the role you played in your friend and patient's life.
Dr. Conant, you're a dermatologist. How did you first start working with people with AIDS?
Because the first disease that we saw, Terry, was Kaposi's sarcoma, which was this malignancy of the skin, which in those days was affecting more than 50% of all the AIDS patients in San Francisco. Remember that the reason that skin disease has been around a long time and skin doctors have been around a long time is that the first organ of the body that we see is our skin. And so dermatology began as a specialty dealing with syphilis back shortly after the time of Columbus. Dermatologists have dealt with diseases like leprosy through history, and it was not surprising that when a disease that manifested itself as a cutaneous, a skin malignancy, Kaposi sarcoma, came along, that many dermatologists were involved. I'm not the only dermatologist. Al Friedman Keene in New York is another dermatologist, and it was actually Al who saw the first cases of Kaposi sarcoma at New York University in 1981.
When did you first realize that something was terribly wrong?
In April of 1981. And you can date it fairly easily because, Terry, there's nothing mysterious about this disease. I mean, this is a sexually transmitted bloodborne disease. I had worked in the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic back in the 1960s as a volunteer when I was in residency. And in those days, we began to see an epidemic of genital herpes. Only about 5% of sexually active young heterosexual and homosexual kids, mostly heterosexual kids, were coming down with genital herpes. But during that period of time, the late 60s and early 70s, when kids started using, experimenting with sex and using sex almost for entertainment, then we saw an epidemic of genital herpes. And now in San Francisco, between 40 and 60% of sexually active young adults are infected with genital herpes. And so over a 20-year period, we went from 5% to 60%. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist in 1981 to find an epidemic of a new disease spreading rapidly amongst gay men in the Castro to realize that the same thing that happened with herpes was going to happen with this disease. Men were having sex with men, they were having multiple sexual partners, and this disease appeared to be sexually transmitted. Those are the elements for a catastrophe.
You know, it strikes me you were probably prepared for a practice of acne and rashes and certain kinds of cancers, but maybe primarily acnes and rashes and just more typical dermatological problems, certainly not a terminal illness like AIDS. Was it hard for you to adjust to what your job was becoming?
It was, but again, take it in terms of the history. In the first 3 to 5 years of the epidemic, Terry, from the time we started seeing these first patients in 81 until, say, Rock Hudson's death and the time the antibody test became available, and that was in 1985. So the first 4 years of the epidemic, I and I think many others working in the field, probably most, believed that we were dealing with something and all we had to do was to bring the spotlights of science on it. We would understand it. And it would stop and go away. And we would go back to our laboratories or taking care of acne and psoriasis or whatever, that we would go back to business as usual. We thought this was going to be something like Legionnaire's disease or toxic shock syndrome or the Tylenol poisonings, all of which occurred around the same time, which if we could just get smart enough, fast enough, we would conquer it and it would go away. And so there was time to adjust to the idea that, yes, we're losing lots of people. But that was in the context of, but this is temporary. Soon our efforts are going to pay off. Beginning about 1985, we then began to realize that this is here for the long haul, that there will be AIDS to the year 2000. There will be AIDS the rest of my professional career. Everyone going into medicine today will wet his or her teeth on patients with AIDS. That's what they will see in medical school, and they will still be seeing those patients when they complete their careers 40 years later.
In your practice, you're tracking, I believe, about 2,000 patients now?
Well, about 3,000, yes.
Oh. Well, are there specific things that you're looking for in your tracking of them? And obviously you're treating them, but you're probably, you know, studying them as well to see what you can learn about the epidemic.
We have tried to answer the question, why are some patients living longer than others? Why do some people seem to handle this disease so well and others do not? Over the years, we have looked for various cofactors, things like cytomegalovirus infections or herpes infections that seem to make the disease spread more rapidly. And we have some patients, perhaps 15% of all the patients we've seen, who've shown no progression at all. I have patients in my practice, Terry, who I know were infected because we have blood samples stored. We know they were infected in 1978. And they still have essentially normal numbers of helper T cells. Now, why is that? Because if we could answer that question and take the patients who are not doing well and modify their immune systems in a similar way, then clearly that would be far more effective than any drug we have. So, yes, we've done studies. That's the good news. The bad news is we have not found any common denominator that we can point to say this is the element that we need to focus on.
Dr. Conant, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Dr. Marcus Conant treats people with AIDS in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, playing against type. We talk with banjo player Tony Trischka. He's taken banjo beyond its expected musical range, playing rock and contemporary jazz. But his new album looks to the past for inspiration, exploring banjo styles through the 19th and 20th centuries. And why does murder fascinate Americans, murder in the news and in popular culture? Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book, Pictures at an Execution, by Wendy Lesser. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In ceremonies today at the White House, President Clinton signed the Brady Bill into law. The measure requires a background check and a 5-day waiting period for people wanting to buy handguns. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
At an emotional White House ceremony today, President Clinton signed the bill alongside its namesake, former White House Press Secretary James Brady. Brady was permanently disabled in the 1981 assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. Along with his wife, Sarah, Brady has been fighting to get the legislation passed for 7 years.
12 years ago, my life was changed forever by a disturbed young man with a gun. Until that time, I hadn't thought much about gun control or the need for gun control. Maybe if I had, I wouldn't be stuck with these damn wheels.
Brady has used a wheelchair since he was shot. According to a survey in the Washington Post, state handgun waiting period laws have already blocked more than 47,000 attempted handgun purchases. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Researchers at the University of Michigan say that they've reached another milestone in using DNA to treat cancer. Scientists injected a gene into melanoma tumors in 5 volunteers to see whether their immune systems would turn against the cancer. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
The idea of using genes to fight disease has taken off dramatically in the past few years. First, genes were injected into cells, which in turn were injected into people. Altered viruses have also been used to carry DNA into disease cells. And now, scientists say they've injected DNA right into people, or actually right into their tumors. The idea was to see if the DNA would encourage an immune reaction against the tumor, like the reaction that causes a transplanted organ to be rejected. The DNA was transferred successfully, according to a report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And Chief Scientist Gary Nabel said that the immune system even fought back somewhat in 1 of the 5 volunteers. But he stresses that the technique is by no means a proven treatment for cancer. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On the second day of a UN-sponsored peace conference in Somalia, 12 factions called on UN peacekeepers to stay on longer than their planned pullout dates. Yesterday, factional leader General Adid, who has boycotted the UN conference, called on peacekeepers to leave the country. Several nations, including the U.S., have said that they plan to leave by March 31st, and the UN mandate is over in May. The conference is aimed at getting the various warring factions together, but Adid and his chief rival are not attending. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 6 points to close at 3,683.95 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Bitter cold temperatures and freezing rain shut down airports in northern France and Belgium and touched off a number of traffic accidents. Early winter-like weather conditions are expected to last well into the night, giving ground staff little chance to clear runways. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is now in Brussels for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers, but his plane was delayed by 5 hours and diverted to England until the weather cleared. According to the Conference Board, a business research group, consumer confidence in the U.S. economy leaped ahead in November. NPR's John Itstey reports.
The Consumer Confidence Index, based on a monthly survey by the Conference Board, surged upward almost 10 points in November, from just under 61% to just over 71%. An improvement that large has occurred only rarely in the 25-year history of the survey. Still, the November reading is at a level usually associated with a lackluster economy, according to Fabian Linden, head of the Conference Board's Research Center. But Linden says the impressive gain in November may suggest better times are on their way. The November survey showed a sharp decline in the number of people who believe business conditions are bad and an increase in the number of people who believe jobs are plentiful. Consumer attitudes are important because consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of the nation's total economic activity. I'm John Idstein, Washington.
In Britain, government officials in London have introduced a new budget for the nation that calls for big spending cuts and sharp tax increases. Britain now has a $75 billion deficit. This new spending plan calls for a cut in military spending in Britain by more than $1 billion over the next 2 years and lower Social Security spending. There would be higher taxes for a number of people, including motorists and airline passengers. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bluegrass fans sometimes get worked into a snit when they hear Tony Trischka. He violates all the conventions of the form, with gusto. His sometimes loopy solos borrow from jazz, rock, and the avant-garde. Trischka has always tried to push the banjo forward, but his new album, World Turning, takes inspiration from the past. It features his interpretations of banjo music from the last 2 centuries, as well as original music inspired by historical styles. Here's an original called Benko's Rag, his tribute to banjo rags of the 1920s and 30s. Most of the songs on Trischka's new album are based on banjo styles that evolved in America. But Trischka opens his album with his arrangement of a tune from Senegal. The banjo's roots are in Africa.
It started in Africa, really, and even in certain parts of the Middle East. But when the slaves were taken to the Americas in the 1600s, they brought with them gourd instruments with necks on them with 3 and 4 strings. These were the early banjos. They were called sometimes banzas or banjos, or in the West Indies they were called merrywangs, which I think is an appropriate name. So I wanted to start in Africa, where the banjo has its roots.
I want to play Alpha Yaya from the album. Could you describe what you're doing in the way that you're strumming on this?
Basically, I'm just finger-picking. This is my take on what the banjo, or not the banjo, but the hollum player, the African player, was doing on his instrument. Mm-hmm. And he has a different instrument. It's not just a banjo, but I transcribe note for note what he was playing for the introduction and for the first few solos. And then from there it gets a little more modernized. But the basic sound I was going for was that African sound. And it's a song about a king who I've talked to a couple of other people about, and he was a very famous king in Western Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of guys from REM on here and Sid Straw. So it has a little more of a modern sound in terms of the vocal approach, because it was done originally as a solo.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear it. And this is Alpha Yaya. Tony Trischka from his new album, which is called World Turning. You do a couple of minstrel tunes on your new album, and you refer to something called the Briggs Banjo Instructor, which you say was considered to be the very first banjo instruction book dating back to 1855. Do you actually have a copy of the book?
I do. I got a copy in Xerox form, and since then it's been reprinted, but it's sort of like finding the Holy Grail or something. Because I was aware of what was going on at the turn of the century, but then they have something that they've had every 2 years called the Tennessee Banjo Institute down in Lebanon, Tennessee, and they get 300 or 400 banjo players together at one time, which is a frightening prospect for some people. But anyway, it was there that I first heard this minstrel style of banjo playing, and the banjos that they used back in the mid-1800s were these low-tuned banjos, much lower tuning, and of course they had gut strings or sometimes wound horsehair, and it's a much funkier sound, and the banjos were fretless. And I fell in love with the sound, and I was told that there was this Briggs banjo instructor that taught the style in 1855. And anyway, so I got a hold of it and taught myself how to play from the book. So even 150-some-odd years later, it still works.
Well, what was the place of minstrel shows in bringing the banjo into white music? You know, because banjo starts off as an instrument related to Africa, and now it's associated with a very white form of music, bluegrass.
Right. Well, the minstrel style was really kind of that bridge. In the Briggs book, Thomas Briggs talks about how he went to the plantations and learned from the Negroes, as he called them. And that's basically, he took that sound and did something to it. It's kind of impossible to say. Unfortunately, there's no actual record of what the slaves were playing, at least on the banjo. But the banjo, actually, even before the minstrel shows, was found in the circus. P.T. Barnum actually had it in his circus in the 1840s. And the banjo player would stand on a board and tap pretty much just the downbeat with the back of his foot and would play in this style. And anyway, it grew from there into this minstrel sound where they added tambourine, bones, which originally, when the slaves played the bones, they actually were animal bones, but later became pieces of wood, and fiddle. And it became, it actually had some roots in England too, but there was a lot of comedy that was done. There were skits done about old Dan Tucker and the devil and things like that. And there was a lot of humor. And, of course, the musicians were in blackface and trying to do, I guess you would say, a parody on the slaves. And there were various stereotypes, like Jim Crow would be the plantation slave. And then there would be just various other stereotypes that would be done for entertainment for the whites, because it was a very exotic sort of thing up north to see what the plantation slaves were doing.
But there's some interesting music that got spread around through this odd tradition.
Exactly. And if you can disassociate the music from the politics of the situation, I guess, there is some very beautiful music that came out of the style. And it was really the first commercial use of the banjo was in these minstrel shows.
Mm-hmm. Now, update the style a little bit. What happens between the minstrel style and bluegrass?
Well, a number of things happened. There was a turn-of-the-century style, which became called the classic style, which was a three-finger style that sort of came in the 1860s, but really became very popular at the turn of the centuries, turn of the century, I should say. And in this case, they were trying to get away from the minstrel show. It seemed like too crude an entertainment. And so the banjoists would dress up in tuxedos and play with orchestras and or piano players, and they could actually read music. And there's some of the very first Edison cylinders featured banjo music right at the very turn of the century. And so it was a much more refined kind of a music, playing light classical music, marches and rags and things like that.
Musician Tony Trischka is my guest. His new album is called World Turning. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with banjo player Tony Trischka. Since so much of your playing has been about expanding beyond bluegrass by going forward or going backwards, do something with like a very basic bluegrass sound for us and tell us what that style is like.
Okay. I'm going to do a song that was the first tune that Earl Scruggs ever played in the three-finger style. And I talked to him a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, Tony, it was like in the movies. I was playing in the two-finger style, and then suddenly that third finger came in there. And this is a tune called Reuben's Train, and this is basically the bluegrass style. Thank you.
Is that the very first style that you learned?
I started with bluegrass, really, yes, in about 1963. And that just got me started. I just loved that sound.
Bluegrass is a very southern style of playing. You grew up in Syracuse, New York, which is in upstate New York.
Right.
So clearly you were, like, geographically far away from the roots of bluegrass. Did you feel emotionally connected to the music?
I felt very emotionally, and I still do, especially listening to the older recordings by Flatt and Scruggs or Bill Monroe, people like that, that were the guys that started it, the first generation bluegrassers. It's hard to explain why that is, but you can go anywhere in the world and find bluegrass fans. I'm probably going to be going to New Zealand in February with Bela Fleck. We're going to do a duet tour there. And there are fans over there, and there are fans in Japan and all over Europe. And there's something about the music that bespeaks an earlier time and maybe a simpler lifestyle or whatever. And there is a very strong emotion to it. And it doesn't matter. I mean, my father was a physics professor, and I grew up, again, up in the north. And yet there's something about it that really resonated with me.
Now, what got you experimenting with the banjo? Why weren't you content with playing straight bluegrass?
Well, like I say, I guess some of these other influences I was hearing, it was just a very natural thing. I wasn't trying to destroy bluegrass, you know, in my own little way or anything like that, because it was and still is at the root of a lot of what I do. And I don't know. I think there's some sort of predisposition that goes beyond even influences. I was just born to be a banjo player, and in that also to stretch the boundaries, just something in my personality that wanted to do that. In fact, I think the very first day I picked up the banjo, I noodled on the melody to Ode to Joy, Beethoven's famous Ode to Joy, and picked that out rather than playing bluegrass. So right immediately I was trying to do different things with the instrument. I wasn't thinking, well, you can't do this because it's a bluegrass instrument, or don't try that, that's not folk music. You know, I didn't have the idea of boundaries.
Have you gotten a lot of resistance from bluegrass audiences, resistance to your experimentation?
Oh, at times, sure. I've had certain less than charitable reviews in some of the publications. It's eased up a little bit in more recent years. I put out a bluegrass record in about 1984, 85, called Hill Country. I wrote most of the tunes, but I tried to do a very traditionally oriented record, and since then I think it's eased up a little bit, because I can say, well, look, I like it. I love bluegrass. Here's this. And then after that, I could go out and do anything wacky I wanted. So, like, on this new record, I have a song with the Violent Femmes, but I think I was validated because of this other record. But yeah, I've had people get actually very angry with me, saying, we came to see you and it said bluegrass and you're playing jazz. And so, you know, even after all these years, there's a you know, people get their dander up about it.
Why don't we hear Down on the Cider House, featuring you and the Violent Femmes, from your new album, World Turning. Tony Trischka on banjo. When people say that you're violating the traditions of bluegrass, does that strike you as a little odd? Because, I mean, you've gone so far back in banjo history that, you know, bluegrass is just another period. It's not the beginning and it's not the end of banjo playing.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, the record just came out a few months ago, so I haven't fully felt the effects of that yet. But if people say, well, you're not playing traditional bluegrass, I can say, look, I'm going 100 years before bluegrass.
Yes,
you know,
right.
You can't get a whole lot more traditional than that. And bluegrass in itself was a fusion of jazz and Scotch-Irish fiddling and blues. And so that's a point to be made. Earl Scruggs was taking Glenn Miller licks and putting it on the banjo and so on and so forth. Bill Monroe recorded with electric guitar in the 50s. And so there is a... there's a tradition in bluegrass of, you know, it is a fusion music in itself. But people like to treat it as a museum piece in some ways, and what Bill Monroe did with Flatt & Scruggs in 1945, which is the original bluegrass band, that's what they hold up as bluegrass. And, you know, if you get too far away from that formula, then it's, then you've got problems.
Tony Trischka's new album is called World Turning. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Unemployment in France has now reached a record 12%. Lynn Terry reports from Paris on the prospects for improving that and talk about a 32-hour work week and job sharing in France. I'll talk with Deborah Amos from London about high unemployment also in Belgium, Italy, and Spain, also about talk in those countries of a four-day work week. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports on the issue of accountability in this country's health care system. President Clinton signs the Brady Bill in a ceremony today in Washington. And Andre Codrescu from New Orleans has some thoughts about Miss America and the problem of worldwide hunger.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Up until now, Wendy Lesser's work as a writer and editor has kept her safely ensconced within high culture. She's the author of an acclaimed feminist study of art called His Other Half. She's also the editor of the Threepenny Review, a well-respected small magazine that features literary and cultural essays. But Lesser's new book, Pictures at an Execution, takes her into more dangerous territory. It's a study of how America looks at murder, both fictional murder and the real thing. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
As someone who teaches a course in detective fiction, I've been especially anxious to read Wendy Lesser's book, Pictures at an Execution. It was scheduled to be published in January, but it mysteriously appeared in bookstores last week, in time for the 30th anniversary of JFK's assassination. The coincidence, I think, was fortuitous. Every November, those films of the motorcade, the gunshots, Oswald, Ruby, and more gunshots loop round and round. Some of the questions Lesser raises here are ones we regular viewers of the assassination might well ask ourselves. Why are we drawn to murder? Why, in particular, are we so interested in seeing murder, either enacted or caught in the act? And is this interest in any way pleasurable? These are questions that are more comfortable to contemplate when you're dealing with fiction. But to her credit, Lesser doesn't just stick to insightful discussions of Macbeth and Crime and Punishment. She also assembles a sprawling exhibit of real-life murder stories. Norman Mailer's The Executioner's Song, Errol Morris's documentary The Thin Blue Line, and interviews with convicted murderers Ted Bundy and Jeffrey McDonald. In fact, the only tough question that Lesser deliberately tries to dodge is the one that's on everybody's mind these days. That is, what connection, if any, is there between violent art and violent behavior? I think despite her initial disclaimers, Lesser does make a case that watching real-life murders, like the kind we see on the evening news, encourages a paralyzing sense of spectatorship that's ultimately damaging to our imaginations and our souls. Think Geraldo. Lesser sometimes rambles after red herrings and false leads, but centering her expansive discussion is an actual legal case, KQED versus Daniel B. Vasquez. This was a trial conducted in San Francisco in 1991. It considered the request of a public TV station to broadcast the execution of Robert Alton Harris in the gas chamber at San Quentin. Lesser attended the trial, which was explicitly about First Amendment rights and implicitly about other messy issues, like how we feel about the death penalty and why we might want to watch an execution. In mulling over that question, Lesser suggests that since our own death is the one event we can't contemplate afterward, we need to extrapolate from the experience of others. Then her meditations become more uneasy. This dying through another seems nothing short of ghoulish, as if sharing in the dead man's singular fate, we make it less his own. She concludes, "This is why our collective presence at a condemned man's execution would be such a violation. It is also why we so long to be there." Lesser doesn't reveal the outcome of the trial or of Harris's numerous stays of execution until the end of her book. If this suspenseful plot structure sounds a little exploitative, Lesser has ensured that her readers are in no position to feel morally superior. On the cover of her book is a black and white photo by the 1940s crime photographer Ouija. It shows an excited crowd of people in a New York street straining to see the body of a murdered racketeer. The minute we readers open pictures at an execution, even though we might tell ourselves we're only intellectually interested in murder, we've just elbowed our way into the thick of that bloodthirsty crowd.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Pictures at an Execution by Wendy Lesser. We recently did a program about the flu vaccine, and we have a correction. Flu vaccines are made up in advance of the flu season based on projections of which strain of the flu virus will strike. One of our guests said that often the projections are wrong, and therefore there was only a 50-50 chance of a flu vaccine matching the virus that's actually going around. According to the CDC, however, over the past 4 years, American researchers have been able to make much more accurate projections and therefore much more effective vaccines. The CDC says there's been a near-perfect match for the past 4 years. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a Sarajevo war journal. We talk with Bosnian journalist Zlatko Dzdarovic. He's continued to publish his newspaper in Sarajevo through the war. His new book is a collection of his own columns. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.